SFDC Consultant is here to support your Salesforce career through interviews, podcasts, videos, and articles about and around the best way to grow and develop as a Salesforce professional. We have a list of high-value and highly packed Salesforce podcast episodes with Salesforce MVPs, administrators, architects, consultants, directors, and developers. Running a Salesforce consultancy is not an easy job. I am sharing a conversation with Emil Vandenberg, where we spoke about the challenges of not just starting but growing a Salesforce consultancy. Emil is managing director of Upper Sigma, a Salesforce consultancy based in London that provides services across multiple continents. Now, please enjoy my conversation with Emil.
My name is Emil Vandenberg. I'm the managing director for Upper Sigma. It's been quite an interesting journey for me to get to this point, having originally grown up in South Africa and now heading up a practice here in the UK space. I'm currently based in London, and from our side, we're an ISV and a solutions integrator.
First thing that I wanted to start with is the consultancy that you are heading. You recently did a rebrand of that. Can you talk me through the process in case we can touch upon that in terms of the reasoning? Was it part of an expansion strategy, or was it something that you're trying to target other industries, or what was your thinking process around that?
Originally, I started a company called Cloudsmiths, based in South Africa, the Africa's largest partner by revenue, certifications, et cetera, and a great organization. At the point where my wife and myself wanted to move to the UK, we then started up the UK entity of it. That was in 2018, and slowly but surely, we grew the team. Cloudsmiths belonged to a holding company called Dynamic Technologies, and Dynamic Technologies has about 13 subsidiary companies ranging from SAP to Inspired Testing, for example. And the group itself has quite a large focus on being able to grow the UK market, so the non-South African or African market space. In South Africa, there's about 1,100 permanent staff in the group, so you can imagine it's quite a large organization. And the group's goal is to, as mentioned, grow the UK space. Us as Cloudsmiths were doing relatively well during this pandemic, and it became more apparent that in order for us as the UK entity to have the growth that we wanted, there needed to be slight changes and nuances as to how we operated. So Cloudsmiths' parent company ended up acquiring the shares of Cloudsmiths in the UK entity, and as a result of that, we needed to become our own practice. So through that, we became Upper Sigma Limited. It was a name change to the same organization, just changing into a different name, but we haven't to start afresh. We can't backbone off our previous parent company. We're now a new consultancy. And with it, there's a lot of challenges that none of us really expected, from timing things to just aspects of social media even. But it's been a very interesting journey to this point, quite an exciting journey that we're looking up ahead.
The other thing I wanted to get your take on, whenever we talk about consultancies, it's not that often, but most of the time, especially like smaller consultancies, they will probably have a niche that they concentrate on. What is your take on that? And do you subscribe to that?
So I do agree with the methodology of having quite a key focus. I don't believe you need to have one key focus, though. You can have two to three because there are similarities in certain parts and where you have experience and logos. But in essence, the way that you look at it from a Salesforce ecosystem is that we as a partner engage with Salesforce account executives predominantly, and they as the executives have their key industry and their key segments. So from a salesperson on the consultancy side, you can't have engagements with 30 different account executives at Salesforce. You're going to have a few niche ones. And by building that reputation and the trust with them to say, this is my key focus that aligns with your one, so you start to segment to become that industry focus. For the guys that don't focus on the industry side, I honestly don't know how they survive. It's more like serendipitous where stuff must land on their laps. Because every time we're with a client, there's always the stringent questions. What experience do you have? Who are your reference clients? What can you illustrate to be able to show that you have that? From our perspective, we focus in the legal space. That's our core identity. And then second onto that is the financial services sector. And that's where we go. But like you said, if you do communities and the sales cloud comes up, that happens all the time. We have quite a few opportunities that we work with in the high technology space from CPQ to communities to Pardot, you name it. We never say no to a project. But as an organization, our persona is to say legal and financial services. And because we're a good set of people, so we can adjust when there are the relevant times.
Are you aiming to grow at a certain point, turn this into a bigger Salesforce consultancy, or are you trying to stay within 10 to 50 employees and potentially pass the mantle, I guess, as the time passes on?
So we have quite rapid growth models ahead of us on a multi-territory perspective and multi-time zone. Already we've greenlighted for an office in the United States and in Australia. So you can imagine the logistical nightmare of such wide time zone spectrums, with the core focus lying in the UK, London sphere as such. So the logistics behind trying to grow a company so rapidly becomes quite complex. You can, as an organization, hire people, but so you need the revenue to be able to afford them that. As you get on these large projects and you move from the SMBs and the growths all the way to the mid-markets and the enterprise, so it becomes a little bit easier because you've got a lot more projects that are fluctuating. But on the same breath, having the right people that are part of the team is one of the hardest parts. My pure philosophy I've always believed on is the corporate culture side. If you don't have team members that share the joy of coming to work and working together, be it remote or in person, the company as itself will always be limited. Our biggest value is our team, and because we have a good team, so we get more clients. So the challenge that we're having now is that as we go into these different time zones and we want to ramp up and double in them by the end of this year and then triple by the end of next year, so accordingly, we have to find the right people that are part of the organization, not just the cheapest or the quickest hire, but the people that will make our brand and representation what it needs to be able to be to grow on a constant basis. Add on to that, so you have to get all the clients to be able to afford those people and have the necessary growth. So it's not just find someone and land a client. Just even the internal upskillment. When you get a new staff member, day one, they're not really on a client. They're getting mentored for around about 3 months. So their efficiency is pretty much next to nothing. But the overheads associated with them, so if I'm mentoring someone or one of our other architects, their efficiency is also reduced. So the internal cost to bring on a person is extraordinary. And you have to know that that person is going to commit over the next 12 months, 18 months and forward. Because let's say, for example, a person wants to leave, to do a handover as well takes several months based on the knowledge and the nuances that you've learned with the clients.
In terms of the productivity and return on investment, I have heard, especially for sales executives, the fact that it can take up to 12, 18 months to actually get that return on investment because depending on, I guess, the level that you hire them, but they need to get familiar with the product. They need to get familiar with the market. They need to get familiar with the initial leads, warm leads, you know, build that. And afterwards, at one point in time, actually, you know, generate those opportunities. Now, in terms of what you mentioned there around building this and expanding across the world, across continents, is there a risk to that? Like, is hypergrowth a risk to you? And I mean, the way I'm thinking about this is very familiar thing where you get like tech startups, Silicon Valley type startups, where they have a product and then afterwards they go and have some type of seed fund. And then 6 months, you know, they have 10 million users or something along those lines. I guess if you flip that, consultancies are a bit more difficult because the only way for you to scale is that you also need people. Basically, people are that time that you're selling is your asset in a way. While tech products, you just up the server in a way. What about the actual hiring process? So in terms of you trying to expand, what is your strategy around finding people in the first place?
I mean, we go through several rounds of interviews as such, but the key thing that I always look for in a person is whether they can think. It's got nothing necessarily to do with what qualification you have, whether you've got a undergrad degree or a doctorate. Certain people can think and have the ability to be able to understand a problem and solve it. And that's the part that we want. If you add on that other characteristics about being caring and meticulous, so you create the perfect scenario. We've gone on quite a few ranges to say, can you get someone that's highly skilled, got lots of certifications? doesn't add any value, really. It's more about person-by-person side. If you look at it, I was on multiple projects before I had even my first administrator certification. Those aren't the characteristics that an organization should look for. However, when you're going on a broad spectrum, you want to go more to say, okay, there's certain prerequisites. You want someone that's got a bachelor's degree. You want someone that's got a admin certification, because typically those people are the ones that can think, but as the recruiter or as the manager that's interviewing, so they can overthrow those requirements to be able to say these are the right people. Key part is always, when we look at it, there's going to be requirements for a job. It might have four different requirements. That's the four ideal requirements. Doesn't mean that you always have to hit all of them. So it's more, if you believe that you're worthwhile, take a chance. If a company sees the value in you, they'll hire you.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of the requirement for university degrees and so on, I remember I was working at this ISV and we were struggling to hire people. And at one point, the job post, we stripped out everything around degrees or anything like that. And it was just be a bright person and willingness to learn, basically. That's all you need, technically. And
it goes to the, if I look at myself, for example, I'm what now 30 years old at the end of this year. By my characteristics and the CV, I wouldn't be able to make a lot of senior positions, because typically you need 10 years of experience in this and this and that. If I can't even match those requirements, how can I dictate that other staff should do that? So you have to treat each person as an individual, not as a number. And it makes the huge difference, because that goes into that corporate culture side of that. A lot of the times our recruiter will be on calls and be like, it's a great candidate, but it's the wrong person for the organization. And that's the key distinguisher.
Thinking about it, the thing that you mentioned there is the fact that not even you have the 10 years of experience, 6 or 7 certifications or 10 certifications. And you are correct. There are a number of jobs out there, senior technical architect or whatever, and they do expect 5 to 10 years on this, and a list of other programming languages and technologies to put in there. And I find it that sometimes it's like, literally, that person must know everything at that point.
It's a team. It's not a person.
Correct. That sounds like a team. Yeah, that you're hiring your entire back-end team in one person. Something to follow up on that you mentioned in terms of the corporate culture falling in that. And this has been a subject of discussion within Salesforce and outside and so on. The fact that there's one thing to hire someone, there's another thing to keep that person, and also for that person's willingness to actually stay and invest their own time and their own values and efforts within the company. What is your take on building proper Salesforce culture, or not really Salesforce culture, but company culture? Are you somehow picking some of the Salesforce-related material that they've put out there? I mean, they have good initiatives in terms of the 1%, the Ohana-type ideology and so on. Is that something that you've also picked internally?
The Lampre 3 model, well, I can't pronounce that now, that Salesforce dictates, it's great. The 1%, we subscribe to that model. We agree with that. As part of our group, we have an internal charity that I don't force our staff to have to follow that, just because it's internal. People are going to have key areas. One of our staff recently just adopted a dog, and her now focus for the rest of this year is on her 1% is helping that organization go through a more streamlined process. So corporate culture, there's the part where you can public expose it to say, us as an organization, we want to look like Ohana, we want to make it seem all good. I disagree sometimes with having to publicize that. It's like when someone does charity work and they take a photo of it for Instagram. Rather do the charity work and let people talk about it because they know about it, then you having to publicize that. So that's where it goes into our corporate culture side, to say we subscribe to doing the Ohana and doing the 1%, but it's more about how good of a team are we together. How is it that when it's someone's birthday, is it a birthday gift that's given out? So there's little nuances. Like today, there's cake that's at the table because someone's birthday, and that's on the table. It's just, you love your team. You love your work. You'll have a barbecue together on a Saturday, even though that's not your working hours, but because you work together the whole time, so you might as well enjoy it with each other. So it might not directly answer your question, but there's the external versus the internal side, which is just as important.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing that pops into my head there is, I think if you only enjoy your coworkers' presence within your Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, I think there's something missing there.
You have to love what you do and love the people that you're with. It's true. You spend so much time with people. The one part that you mentioned, though, is that 9 to 5 side. I believe those days are long gone as such. So now it's all about understanding and trusting also your team so that people can try and respect that 9 to 5, so that you don't have that one guy that's wanting to start work at 7 o'clock and finish at 3, where he's saying, okay, that we need to have the calls at 7, but the other side of the team wants to finish at 9 o'clock at night. It's important that as a team, everyone knows how to operate, rely on each other, but also make each other's or make independent decisions as such.
The thing that I wanted to touch upon is the fact that you said that the 9 to 5 is gone. So what is your policy in terms of assessing someone's outputs or productivity while not looking at hours, or not really hours, but kind of set schedules?
We've got quite a unique method that we're still trying to implement. It's not an easy change management, to say the least. But the idea is that on a Monday, you start together. Everyone needs to start at the same time so that you start off the day planning for the week ahead. And as a team, be it the delivery or the non-delivery team, so they have their relevant meetings and everyone's in agreement, and they've got the cadence and the aim for that week. During the course of that week, you then end off as a team together, not where some guys finish work early and the rest then have to carry on until Saturday morning, for example. But rather, if someone's still working, then everyone's still working, so that as a team, we resolve those issues. In between that part, the big thing that we're working on is the value of life side. Consultancies typically have a bad premise of pretty much overworking staff. You subscribe to the 160 hours on average a month, minus productivity time, averages to 140. But if you as a staff member are efficient, you shouldn't have to do double the amount of work because you are brilliant at what you do. So we work on this method of a value hour. It's on a method of a value hour versus a productive hour. So if a project would take 40 hours, but as a consultant, you can achieve that in less because you're meticulous, you don't break stuff X, Y, Z, then you need to be rewarded accordingly for that. Our premise that we also work with our clients is on a pure fixed price side. We don't do time and materials. We keep it that this is what you're going to charge. And we then manage it with our team for them to be more efficient. So that it's a win-win scenario. And that's where that 9 to 5 on our side is going to change fundamentally, because it goes down to say, do your job properly the first time around. Do it with the team so that the team finishes correctly. And everyone wins. During the time, you're on the 9 o'clock stand-up every day, so everyone's aware. But after that, like with how the weather's lovely now, might as well go in and enjoy it and have a suntan.
Based on what you said, there is this concept of, like you said, consultant life and always on the road or always working and putting those hours in. The second thing related to that is potentially the actual billable time that you're billing in. And I think I had someone on the podcast and we're talking about 80% of consultants' time to be billable time by the company. But you just said that you do not charge clients daily or daily rates, I guess. You charge per project. So how are you implementing that with, I guess you must have a very good project size estimator as part of your onboarding of a new project.
So it goes down to the fact that our sales guys aren't salespeople. I've run many large enterprise projects to lots of small projects. I'm a very technical consultant, and that's how our sales team does it. So when they say, sure, we're going to make a promise, it's a project and a promise that is possible and likely. And when we don't know, we inquire first from the delivery team versus going and saying that Salesforce is going to make you coffee, which, interesting enough, when I was in the Czech Republic at a base camp there, they had Salesforce making coffee. So it is possible. But we do believe in the principle that promise the right stuff up front, spec out the projects correctly, have the right inclusions and exclusions so that you know what you're presenting, but also that the client knows what they're getting. There's so many times where there's these loose scope projects that we take over and the client assumes stuff and they got half of that or a complete mismatch. And then that also goes down to the project methodology. A lot of these firms these days are working on Agile and everyone's loving Agile because it's a shared responsibility model. All it means in my mind, and this is just a pure opinion, when consultants go on the Agile side and they're saying it's shared responsibility, they're saying it's shared because we couldn't, as a consulting firm, control our processes and our requirements analysis process. So we're going to pass that sharing on to you, client, and you're going to now have to be more strict on this. So all it does is it takes it into a time and materials process. And in the end, your hands can only do so many hours in a day. Whereas if you can have the right processes to say on the fixed price side, this is the risk that's associated with the project. This is the return on investment. Does it warrant it? Client can easily say yes or no. And the internal teams can then strive towards greater efficiency so that you can get that value of real life. You're not always pushing those staff members to say, you know, I need 150 hours, I need 160, I need you to do overtime here and there. Do what you can do. Do what's the best for the client. And as a result, everything ends up working.
I have heard, like I said, of the challenges that potentially Agile and the idea of shared responsibility brings forward on that. Now, the other thing I wanted to ask about is relating to onboarding and relating to training and, you know, stuff that you mentioned earlier. I was speaking to a consultant a few days ago, and she had a background, funny enough, working in South Africa and then moving to a bigger consultancy. And we were talking about how she actually picked up the Salesforce skills and all of that. And she was saying, like, working at a smaller company was extremely valuable because at that point you did not have different teams. You did not have a trainer, a consultant, a pre-sales consultant. There were a number of people that basically had multiple hats that they had to switch. So the breadth of skills that she was able to develop was quite big. Is that something that you also subscribe to? And what are the kinds of tasks or roles, for example, would you take on while, you know, on a regular week or a regular month?
Yeah, so I absolutely agree with that. When you're in these large teams, you've got your business and or your multiple business analysts, and they go and they get in the requirements. And then you've got the consultants that do certain stuff. You've probably got a backup admin that's doing minor tweaks for some devs, the front end, the back end, all the way through to architects, and you've got this very expensive team that the efficiencies aren't really that good unless you've got a really good scrum or project manager that's driving this team successfully. Whereas when you're on the small project, one, you have to Google stuff, so you can't just ask for help all the time, and you find out the questions and the solutions so much quicker. It takes a little bit longer, but you remember it and it makes you as a consultant a far better person. So, I mean, there are also perks to working in large teams because you learn a lot more complex scenarios because those typical projects aren't going to be an express it if you're dealing in the enterprise space to have such a large team on that. I do have a different opinion sometimes, and it goes to a methodology in Japanese called Jemba. It's part of how Toyota became the organization they were. It translates to on the ground. So go and take a look at what's happening on the ground and then be able to make the changes from there. There was quite a large bank in Africa that I've worked on quite a bit. And in this project, the business analysis team wasn't really getting the requirements that we needed to be able to present that back at the end of the sprints. So, and every single time the project sponsor would be saying, good work, but you didn't quite get there. So instead of sitting in some dark office trying to do work, I sat with the advisors at this bank and just listened to their conversations on a daily basis, understanding that and then being able to deliver it and run it with the team. That's that whole process to say that sometimes a smaller, more on the ground team can derive far greater value.
The last thing I wanted to ask you was in regards to starting a consultancy. And I'm just thinking not really starting a one-man band, turning freelancer or turning contractor. I think that most of the time it's those people that probably end up setting up consultancies. They're probably aware of the risk, they're comfortable with it. What would be some of your advices or nuggets you can recommend to people trying to or planning to start their own Salesforce consultancy?
It's really not easy, and it's lonely in the beginning because, as with it, there's only so much CapEx that you have. So you'd be starting this off by yourself. You don't have that team like what I've got now, where we as a group go out for drinks, for example. You're by yourself. You're probably, even with COVID, sitting at home or maybe going to a coffee shop in the normal times to get operating, not really seeing people that much. And then in addition, you're selling and delivering simultaneously. So there's always that risk of once you do sell, you now have to deliver. And then by delivering, you're not able to sell. And if you don't sell, then it becomes a vicious circle. So it's really not easy. The key thing that we found that led to our success is build the right relationships with the right people at Salesforce. And if it might sound easy, you think that it's just a LinkedIn message or call. It's not that. It took us probably about a year to get traction with one account executive. It was also a little bit more difficult because I'd come from South Africa here. I didn't have any network as such in South Africa. You know everyone. It's a relatively small place. Even though landmass is bigger, but you know people. Whereas the traction to get that trust and that reliance, because those Salesforce AEs, when they bring you onto an op, if you mess up, that's their revenue that they've lost. That's their promotion that they're not going to strive towards. But once you get that trust, it's a very vocal organization. The good AEs, they always have a new person coming on board and they then talk on and on and on. And so you can go from that one to 10, 15, 20 different AEs that you're dealing with. So just, don't expect to have this massive growth unless you already know a lot of people in the industry.
Thank you for your time. Thank you for sharing all these points and some of the things that you've learned on the way. Are you a social media type of person? What's your social media platform of choice and how could people reach out and see what you're doing?
So as a company, we've got all the different platforms from LinkedIn, Twitter, you name it. You can go onto Twitter and see the joke of the day. Each morning a staff member has to make a joke to make everyone laugh, and we're publicizing that from this morning on Twitter. So we're on all those platforms. Me personally, my preferred one is LinkedIn. So feel free, please follow us as an organization, Alpha Sigma. And if you have any questions, just personally directly message me on LinkedIn and I'll try to respond as soon as possible.
Thank you for listening to the SFDC Consultant Podcast. Be sure to visit sfdcconsultant.com to access the show notes and discover additional content. If you enjoy the podcast, it would be amazing if you could subscribe, give us a review, and share it with your peers. Until next time, take care.